I am from Minnesota, and I just, honest to God, don't expect a lot. I'm glad to just spend a few quiet moments here with you, here in a sort of a cloakroom as you wait to leap up and go off and vote, or whatever you may be doing this evening. I was chosen to come because I know less about Bruce Vento being his constituent than any of the rest of you in this room. The few times that I've come to Washington to lobby for public broadcasting and for the National Endowment for the Arts, I did not bother talking to Congressman Vento because he already supported it, so I never got a chance to come around and lobby him. I went off to talk to Republicans who had reservations about trends in American photography. And I had the experience of walking into one office after another and having a gentleman push a batch of Xeroxes across the desk towards me that Senator Helms's office had sent around. And I discovered the truth of that saying of Mark Twain, that naked people have little or no influence in society. It certainly was true for the NEA. Bruce Vento, when he comes back to St. Paul to campaign, is a very quiet and, I must say, self-deprecating candidate. He's not one to blow his own horn, and he doesn't really need to because St. Paul includes a lot of yellow dog Democrats like myself. We vote for Bruce Vento because he has the Heckscher mark of the Democratic Farm Labor Party on him. And we don't look any too closely any more than you would look closely at your parish priest. We believe in a sort of apostolic succession, a sort of blessing that's been passed down from Herbert Humphrey to Walter Mondale and by way of Gene McCarthy, and so the 4th District, St. Paul and Ramsey County, has had but 3 congressmen in the last 50 years: Gene McCarthy, and Joe Carth, and Bruce Vento, a high school science and social studies teacher, and a union guy, and a Benedictine poet. And we're proud of all 3 of them, about equally. They were our guys. And on behalf of the people of St. Paul, I just am really touched by all of you who have come to this dinner this evening and to see how highly our guy is regarded here in Washington. We hope so, but it's good to see you. Now, a place, people associate a place like St. Paul with some of its more famous sons and daughters, and St. Paul has often been confused with F. Scott Fitzgerald because he came from there. But of course, St. Paul is not anything like F. Scott Fitzgerald, and that's why he couldn't wait to leave. He had a great deal of elegance and romance about him, and it would have been wasted on us. So he took off for the coast, and most people were glad to see him go. So far as we know, he never admitted to any nostalgia for St. Paul whatsoever. St. Paul is not F. Scott Fitzgerald. F. Scott Fitzgerald comes from a little neighborhood of St. Paul, Ramsey Hill, Summit Avenue, but that's not St. Paul. St. Paul is a much more blue-collar city than Fitzgerald was ever interested in writing about. It has a certain redneck strain that it is proud of. It is a city of hard-working German and Irish, and I guess I better include Italian, immigrants who keep their noses to the grindstone and who are devoted to their Holy Mother, the Church, and who are a little bit suspicious of outsiders and of people who put on airs. Bruce Fento is a St. Paul guy. He's not a Fitzgerald character whatsoever. He doesn't have a shred of Fitzgerald in him. He is charismatic only to his friends. He's a man who's from the east side of St. Paul, and that's very different. The family's name, I believe, originally was Valentino, not Vento, and it was shortened because Valentino has associations that would not be useful to anybody in politics. We want to believe that politicians are either not interested or incapable, and if they are, we don't want to know about it. He comes from another part of St. Paul that is more like the people I come from, and although he grew up Catholic and I grew up Protestant, we come from the same background, and it taught us the same sorts of things. It taught us to not feel sorry for ourselves, because it's not about you. It's about the other people. It's about work, but it's not about you. You're not the center of it. You're not the first person who's ever gone through this, so don't take it too personally. Make yourself of use. Be useful. Pull your weight. Do your part. Be a good worker. Be a good worker. Everybody knows what a good worker is. Worker doesn't let down the other people who are working around you. You keep hold of the line, and you don't let go of it, and you don't make cheap displays that other people who know you well know are dishonest. And if you're elected to Congress, you buckle down and you do it. You are passionate to the principles that you were elected to serve, to the people who you were elected to speak for. You were sent to Washington to raise taxes on people like me. And though it's not a safe district, nonetheless, what loyalty you have in your account, you put to good use. And you use it to work bravely for things that don't pay a big political bonus. I don't know how the people on the east side of St. Paul feel about national parks. I doubt that national parks are at the top of their list. It's a brave and a good thing for their congressman to go do what needs to be done in behalf of that. Minnesota is a good place to teach a person about politics. For one thing, growing up in Minnesota, you realize that you are the object of mass national indifference. You realize that the majority of Americans don't have a clear idea of where Minnesota is, and it is not important to them. Except once every couple of years when we have a serious storm and comes down out of Saskatchewan or Manitoba. And then we get on the evening news, briefly. And the evening news says 11 killed in deadly blizzard. And we sit in the comfort of our homes in St. Paul and we watch this. Scenes from hell, really from a tundra that we don't recognize from real life, but they're quite impressive on television. And we realize the myth-making capability of the media. We sit and watch this story, knowing full well that blizzards kill very, very few people, actually, outright. Many people, in fact, were planning to die about the time a blizzard comes along. And they decided they would rather do it with their overshoes on, and so they went out and they shoveled their driveways in much the way as an elderly Eskimo might take the long walk across the ice. And other people die in blizzards as the result of having done incredibly stupid things. They die because somehow hearing travel warnings aroused heroic urges in them to drive into town 15 or 20 miles for a bag of pretzels. And And this they did, fulfilling some destiny. These deaths are a kind of natural selection, and have to be regarded differently. We look at these dire stories about a blizzard, and we sit in the comfort of our homes, and it's like the stories about scandal in Washington, in a way. The story about the blizzard is not meant for us. It's of no use to us. It's of no point, really. It doesn't represent our experience, and it's not helpful information. It is meant for people in Arizona, actually, to make them feel better about living on the desert. Just so stories about scandal in Washington, which is when Washington really is illuminated for most of us out in the hinterlands. Stories about scandal have very little to do with the reality of Washington. It is an occasion for the press to go around and shoot the wounded and the elderly, and everybody else goes on with their real business. It's an amusing story to people outside Washington, and of course it's a very good story if one can dwell on speculation and not be hamstrung by the facts. But it's a story that is for entertainment. The real story is, as always, the fact that people get up in the morning and they go to work. And that's, to me, is the story of Bruce Minto. He was brought up to get up in the morning and go to work. And despite all of the discouragements of life and the sorrows and all of the pains that we go through, nonetheless, after all of it and after all of the regrets and after realizing one night that you will never be 27 years old again, and even though it's good to believe in your own dreams, nonetheless your chance at a major film career have really faded now. You look a lot older than you feel. If Julia Roberts saw you, she would not be interested. Her glance would not even dwell on you for very long. We come to terms with all of these things, and then we get up in the morning, and America goes to work. And that's the story. That is the story. Week after week after week, year after year after year. We get up and we go to work. We complain about it in a ritual way, but we do not curse it any more than farmers would curse the sun, because it is a blessing. And so we go off to be blessed by it. We're so pleased that we were able to contribute to the U.S. Congress a man who we're very proud of as a good worker, a man who lives out here in Washington, far from the Mississippi, lives out the ethic that he was brought up with of modesty and courage and passion. We love him so much that we are almost ready to say so, but instead of saying so, I am now going to introduce a brief but very illuminating video on his life. Mr. Congressman Bruce Minto, thank you.
He went down to the Union Depot in Powell here, and he met Mr. Truman. Dad took him and Danny down there that time. I'll never forget that.
At that time, they had these open touring cars, and he ran alongside of the car, and Truman, you know, he kind of stuck out his hand and waved at him, and he just got the biggest bang out of that.
Just what a wonderful man. He came home, he says, Ma, boy, I tell you, I wouldn't mind being in his boots. That's what he made up his mind. He was going to go into politics.
Yeah.
He always was a very compassionate person for people that have problems, or if somebody said, well, I haven't got the money right now, turn the paper out. And then the lady said, I only can pay you half now. My husband isn't working and stuff. So Bruce used to let it slide by. He says, well, forget about it. He says, I'll just take it out of my money that I would earn.
Yeah.
You know that lady afterwards when he was running for office? Gave him a $25 donation, and she was on Social Security by that time.
Bruce first became congressman representing the 4th District. The 4th District was pretty much contained within the boundary limits of St. Paul area. It was a blue-collar district. And Bruce knew from his background what it meant to have a good job and to have a livable wage because he came from a union family. He believes in helping those that can't help themselves, the working class people of this country.
It's about roots. And when an issue like dislocated workers comes up, Bruce comes from a lunch bucket roots. You're not going to forget that.
Bruce never forgot where he came from. He never forgot how he got there. And he never forgot what his mission was.
You know, you're not going to pick up a lot of votes from the homeless community. And yet, that was a major issue for him. And so for somebody to decide that that was important, even though there was no political gain in it, was important to me.
It was some year, the 80s or so, we suddenly, in charity, saw all kinds of people on the streets that we hadn't seen before. People are homeless. And so we opened the Dorothy Day Center, and Bruce came over to visit, see what was happening there. And he talked with the guys who were in there, and he realized that homelessness was just one aspect of the problem, that there were all kinds of difficulties here. So he saw all this, and he got on that McKinney Act. And that still is the most important federal program, and the only one, really, that's effective for homeless people.
One time he became involved in an issue that I just absolutely became incensed with him about, because I felt he was making a bad mistake. And that was, there was a big dispute up in the Boundary Waters.
I remember going up with Bruce to Ely, Minnesota. They had a hearing up there, and Bruce was the chair of the hearing. And we drove in that day, and there were the logging trucks outside. They had, Bruce sent a hanging in effigy outside the hall.
And I said, "Well, Bruce, I'm going to tell you, you've signed your death warrant as it relates to you ever being able to run for a statewide election, because the 8th District will never, ever forget what your involvement means in this issue." He said, "Bill, I can't help it. Not only will I do as I'm asked, I believe in it."
Bruce made the most beautiful, impassioned speech about why we protect land and why wilderness is important to people. And, that was one of the great moments, I think, where he just made such a stirring statement under such unfriendly conditions.
A freshman member coming in and playing that big a role in protecting the most popular wilderness in the United States is his greatest accomplishment.
Because of what Bruce Bento has done, there will be these tremendously beautiful, inspiring, spiritual places that people for generations to come will be able to visit.
Legacies. Basically, caring for people and caring for the future, I think, in terms of putting it in a broad perspective.
It's nice to be able to brag about your congressman to other people.
Well, Bruce may be retiring from Congress, but he's not going to be retiring from life. He's not going to retire from these important causes, because there are a lot of us in the wings who are going to keep nudging him along, because we need Bruce Bento for a long time to come.
Bruce Bento stands for something, and I want you to go on standing for it. I believe you will. I believe you can. Now go and do it.